didn't say
did
hello.
I forget? I'm Jean Carlson. I thought I'd just write these down since Jim did, and then I could talk a little bit about things just to get this started. This is not like we're supposed to talk all about this, but these were some of the things I was just this morning thinking about after spending some time yesterday with Jim and Anail and Greg talking about sort of interesting problems that we saw as opportunities to think about this program with granular materials. So let me just, okay. Some of this, I think, shows up already, but I'll later. Okay, so one of the things that struck me when I started to think about today was that we had a program just ending like a month ago on granular materials here at IPP, and it was almost completely orthogonal group of people except for people who live here. And that group of people, a little bit more of that group of people, I think, came out of a traditional physics background, and about 15 years ago there was a real blip up of interest in granular materials as an example of sort of a complex system, and a lot of really interesting experiments people were looking at again and thinking about new ways to describe these systems and what makes them interesting. But it's different, I think, from a lot of the kinds of questions that we've heard about so far in this program, and very different from my conversation yesterday with Jim, which was very much about getting constitutive laws out and what matters in the context of earthquakes. So I thought I would at least say a few words. That Jim. Jim Wright. Jim. Okay, anyway, I wanted to just at least come back to that because I think it's interesting, and those of us that were here and involved in the process very much lobbied to try to get these two programs to happen at once, because I think they provide interesting perspectives potentially for each other, and I want to at least bring this up, and maybe some of these topics will be things that people can talk about more during this program. In any case, granular materials are an interesting challenge because they exhibit behaviors across a real broad spectrum of behaviors, like gas-like behaviors on some regime, bubbling and things like that, liquid-like behaviors, and solid-like behaviors. They have a wide separation of time scales, including avalanching phenomena, large fluctuations in forces in the material, the interesting pattern formation, instabilities. One of the interesting things about granular materials, I'm not going to go into the details of any of these things, I'm just going to list them and say they're things people are thinking about talking about. But flows that go seem to have waves that go upward or downward depending on things like chute geometries. So a lot of the work in the previous program was thinking about idealized geometries that might have some sort of analog sometimes in industry, but really trying to probe packing configurations and things like that we haven't talked about too much here yet. One of the interesting opportunities associated with granular materials for me is that they are bigger than atoms, and so you have an opportunity to potentially visualize the internal variables that we're talking about so much as potential state variables here in this program. So some of the kinds of internal structures that people have been studying are the appearance of force chain networks in packings and also in shear flows and the like, in boxes. Local rearrangements subject to shear, there's some work on that that are reminiscent of these sorts of STZs, but I think a lot more can be done. Things like density variations, shear boundary layers, apparently, although in granular flows you can see that the motion, if you look all the way into a path, tends to go all the way in, it just slows down. One of the things that makes this such a challenge is that granular materials lack basic constitutive relations. They show clear history dependence, like we talked about in things like rate and state laws. They allow visualization of potential state variables, but there really aren't good constitutive relations. And so one of the things that people here talk a lot about are constitutive relations that can be used at larger scales for things like geophysical problems. Well, that is not just, of course, a problem for geophysical problems. There's all kinds of things, even itty-bitty things like MEMS assembly, where friction and constitutive relations having to do with contact dynamics are slowing progress down in terms of applications. So one of the interests in studying granular problems is the ability to visualize whatever your internal state variables may be. So the tools for this that people are using to approach the granular material problem are trying to derive constituent relations that are somehow or other based on some microscopic processes that come out of laboratory experiments or simulations. And there's a bunch of different kinds of simulation techniques that are being used for these, for granular materials. Contact dynamics, that's the ones that we've been working on with our group. These are ones where you really think about a system that's hard spheres and try to resolve, you know, the forces in collisions that can allow for large groups. There's molecular dynamic simulations based on soft spheres. There's Monte Carlo techniques, and there's very simple idealized systems. People also try to come up with sort of mathematically sharp theories that have to do with packing rearrangements, basic things about whether or not, you know, what is random close packing? Really basic questions to try to solve using simulations, experiments, and theory. What's random close packing? You know, is there an algorithm that can always generate it? You know, what kinds of materials, you know, pack better than others? We had a talk on granular packings. In this meeting, I think granular packings would probably be rocks. You know, if you talk about shapes and granular packings and friction and granular materials, we've been talking about wide distribution of shapes, things with sharp edges that may get stuck in each other and break off. In the previous program, there were M&Ms, and we got to eat them during the conference and program, and the M&Ms pack more densely than spheres, and so that's the kind of idealized system that people are looking at and kind of on the other end. So one of the theoretical communities that have been trying to characterize granular materials have come at this problem really from two opposite ends. And part of the other program was, I think, grappling a bit with this issue of the dilute limit or gas-like limit and this much more dense limit. So Greg's talk that was the week before the conference talked a little bit about some of the things that we've been trying to think about in this regime. The dilute limit really comes from extending ideas from kinetic theory, where you imagine that all the collisions you have are binary collisions, and maybe there's some dissipation associated with these collisions, but it builds on theories of molecular flow in gassy systems. And it doesn't get you towards the dense limit that we've been talking about mostly in this program. Right? It's going to break down. And so we've been probing the breakdown of that with simulations, and then there's this other side of people that want to talk about the dense limit. So they come at it from a side that's thinking about jam systems, thinks about amorphous solids. So Jim Langer is thinking about shear transformation zones as a way to talk about fracture and amorphous solids. And Anail, when he was here, took that theory and was generalizing that for granular materials by incorporating a kind of dilate sphere effect of temperature. And Jim has been thinking about that as well recently too. And so a lot of the work that we've been trying to do coming at this from the dense limit really starts with something that thinks about an amorphous solid subject to shear, which is kind of the opposite end. And I think, again, because granular materials shows all these behavior, it would be very interesting to find some kinds of constituent laws and descriptions that can span the range of regimes. Clearly, when you have things like shear bands and dilute regions where most of the slip is localized, you need to be able to talk about the ranges. So in any case, that's the kind of thing that happened in the previous conference and workshop. And I think one of the things that came out of talking to Jim Rice and Jim Dietrich the other day is this issue of, you know, kind of what do we hope now to get out of granular simulations, and, you know, what kinds of things are important in terms of making these connections between granular simulations that we're doing and processes in the Earth. And so that makes you sit over here at this dense limit. And the first thing that comes up is, you know, whether or not these granular simulations can produce some of the kinds of effects in the constitutive laws, like the Dietrich-Marina law that we've been talking about, like the direct effect. And do you need to put in a more sophisticated frictional contact rule between your particles in order to see some of these phenomena? Again, that has not been where we've been coming at it, because we've been trying to look at the amorphous solid rearrangements within it. But I think it's an interesting question about what do you put into these simulations in order to see at a more macroscopic level some effective friction law. And how much detail at these contact points do you need to incorporate? So there's sort of a contact friction and an effective friction that both come into the problem. Okay. At the level, and then the question is, if you put in some sort of quasi-static contact law, can you extract some of the things that need to happen differently at large fast flows, so dilatancy and some of the other things that may not be part of your contact friction law. The other thing that I just wanted to mention, and then I'll give it to Jim, is that things that look like granular media simulations are used in lots of ways when you get into the earth sciences. So I remember being very struck the first time I saw Peter Mora's simulation, which are these things that are, instead of trying to talk about grains as individual grains that might be rocks or pieces of gouge or something like that, he used a granular material type of simulation really to model the whole evolution of fault network-like processes. So it's a little bit kind of thing too that Yehuda has been thinking about, but in any case, there are granular media type simulations at much larger scales. And what can those tell us about seismicity and evolution of fault networks in the earth? So those are my comments. Okay, your turn.
Peter will be coming back.
Oh, okay, good. Yeah, so those are really interesting simulations, and he's trying to address issues at much larger scales than the ones that we've been talking about.
I have a small list here, but something I think if I could make a comment on, I mean, this is very important where we live along this range between quasi-static and fast flows. And you might think earthquakes live over here, but I don't think they do, and I'll tell you why in a moment. But it has nothing to do with, or very little to do with how fast the shear is. Much more it depends on the fact that they happen at enormous levels of normal stress. And in the granular materials literature, at least as established for 2D simulations of round disks of comparable size, there's something called an inertia number defined. And let's see if I can get this right. So shear rate times particle size is the velocity. So of course, that has units of stress. And what you want to divide is by the normal stress, and the people who introduce this normally take a square root. So here's the problem. We know roughly what the density is in the Earth. It's of order of 3,000 kilograms per cubic meter. The normal stress. If I take the overburden at typical depths where earthquakes nucleate, that's of order 100 MPa. We got asked the other day what an MPa was. Anyone here need that? I imagine the string theorists just use other units for stress, which I'm not sure. Stress may be a concept they don't need. But okay, so now we have gamma dot D. And in fact, I've got statements over here how small particles are. But if in this disk simulation case, suppose I say I want to accommodate a velocity over a thickness. Now, a well-known rule in granular materials is the thickness of any localized shear zone that develops, at least in sand and in many simulations, is of order 10D. If you want to use 5D or 20D, it will make no difference. But the point is D cancels out. Okay, so this turns out to be velocity over a number of order 10. And the velocity, if I use an average velocity in an earthquake, it's about a meter a second. So that constrains you. And when you do that and put in a sensible density here, so you can do the calculation yourself, but of order 3,000 kilograms per meter cubed, you get this inertial number down in the range less than 10 to the minus 3. So that's long. And I think Anil checked me on this. Am I remembering right? Is Anil? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is that what? Yeah. So we got this less than 10 to the minus 3. Now, the claim of the group of Chavoir, and Anil tells me he has checked this and is consistent with their simulations, is that if this is less than about 3 times 10 to the minus 3, you're basically insensitive to motion, to inertia. Inertia simply doesn't matter, and you have from granular simulations an almost constant friction coefficient. So that's a question for the simulations, just where do we live with earthquakes? And this suggests that the critical factor has little to do with strain rate and particle size. If you change this by 2 orders of magnitude, then you could rise up out of this range. Or if you reduce that dramatically. So maybe if processes like pore pressure elevation in fault zones are real, by the time you get the pore pressure up towards the normal stress, then this number has reduced to a small fraction of what it began its life as, and then you may get into a terminal range in earthquake slip where particle inertia matters. But it does not seem to matter. Typically. So I just thought.
Can I say one thing though?
Sure.
I guess maybe the word fast flows in this situation is better replaced by other mechanisms that we're not taking into account with our granular simulation. So heating,
okay.
You know,
right.
Fluids.
Oh, I'm all in favor of those.
You know, that's what I mean. So I mean, almost like, you know, so if you think Dietrich Arena is a good description of sort of basic slip processes at rough interfaces, then the question is what happens when you get into energy scales where heating or some other thing might take place, opening modes, all these other phenomena. And the hope is maybe granular materials will get us there.
Yeah, so I just put, we're very interested, and I have one student started recently on DEM or granular type simulations for earthquake physics, but I guess the issues I've listed here are some of the challenges that some of these you know how to deal with, others there's no idea at all.
Jim, before you make this argument.
Sure.
You said that the guys were saying 3 times 10 to the minus 3 is sort of a cutoff. So, another way to say it is we're pretty close to having it matter. And
well, let's put numbers
you
in.
Make instead of 1 meter a second, you make it 10 meters a second.
Let's put numbers in and see how close we are. Okay, let's do that. And someone better check me on this. I always get this stage wrong. Let's see, that's the square root of, what do we have? 30 over 100. 30, square root of 30. What's square root of 30? 5, 6? So I is equal to 6, and then square root of m is 10 to the 3. And then we have a number of order 0.1. Yeah, so I think this is 0.6 times 10 to the minus 4, or 0.6 times 10 to the minus 3. So yes, you would be up there. You would need if you were running at 10 meters a second, fine. But you know, it's not as if there's a sudden transition. There's a gradual change, and this is sort of their judgment call, the number 3 times 10 to the minus 3. But yes, you might be beginning to see a little bit of inertial effects in the particles if, say, near a rupture front, you got up to 50 meters a second slip rate or something quite plausible.
Or if you go up the normal stress at the rupture front.
Yes, or if you lower the normal stress at the rupture front.
Okay.
But that sits under square root, so you have to really knock it down.
And can you say something on this number 10D comes many times, people have mentioned, where is it coming from?
Well, it is the observational data on sands, say the localization thickness varies from about 6D all the way up to 30D in different circumstances. Most of the stuff that gives a wide zone is because Well, there are artifacts that can come in. But when you see localized zones in natural materials of a narrow size distribution, it is of order 10D. So Roscoe, the Cambridge soil mechanician, said this many years ago, and hordes of people have studied that since. In the heating and weakening paper, you can find a set of references there to the literature. And a good number of simulators have said that too. If you wake up any person who does granular material simulations in the middle of the night and say, how thick is the shear zone, you'll hear 10 to 20 particle diameters or some answer like that. So it's just, it seems to be a folklore in the area, but I think it's one that's true. Okay.
Just to this point, I mean, I guess the reason I'm kind of interested is I'm surprised we're as close to having inertial matter at these tiny scales, because if you...
Well, tiny doesn't matter, Bruce, because tiny disappeared. D canceled 1 over D. Well, so these could be boulders.
If you look at it from a continuum point of view, the smaller scale, the bigger scale you get, the more inertia matters.
Yeah.
So.
Well, if you were imposing a strain rate, what you say would be completely correct. But if I want to accommodate a given velocity over a thickness that scales with the size of the particles, which is more the granular materials situation, then the thickness would cancel out. Now, I should say that the observed size of localized shear zones in the gouge of the Punch Bowl Fault is of the order of 200 microns. The average particle size, D50 in the granular materials terminology, in that case, of course, it's a very wide size distribution, but it's 1 micron. So this number would be not 10, but more like of order of a couple hundred, so that would knock you down more. But in any event, I think we're simply usually not in a range where the most important thing in sight is the inertia of the particles. Now, the dilation of the particles is probably always important, but that gets to the first thing on my list. You've got to think of that in presence of a dense fluid that doesn't like being squeezed through narrow pore spaces if you have a very fine granular material. So that's a big inhibitor to widespread fluctuations in packing density. Of course, local rearrangement's easy because you don't have to move fluid very far for that. But widespread volumetric fluctuations are harder because of that. But also, this is a challenge for simulations. And the only thing I've seen in the literature, though perhaps there's more, the group at Nottingham of King and Swift, simulators in granular materials, did a number of experiments where they showed particles of equal size but different mass would segregate in interesting ways when you shook them. They found that when they did the same experiment in vacuum, there was no segregation. So it was very clear that, in fact, that if you shake a pack of particles back and forth, as they move through the air, there's a drag on them. And they have devised a kind of seat-of-the-pants way of doing this, which effectively solves the continuum porous medium equations in the simplest case when the fluid is incompressible. They basically solve a field equation for the average pore pressure and take its gradients as giving the Darcy drag force on the particle which is moving through the fluid. So you get an average fluid motion from the pressure field and pressure gradient of permeability, which depends on packing density in the neighborhood. And from that, you take the difference between a local particle velocity and the average fluid velocity to get a Stokesian drag force on their particles. Of course, it's a great perturbation to the numerical solution, but it's feasible, whereas solving the Navier Stokes or just Stokes equations in the space between the particles is utterly unfeasible. So that, to me, is attractive, and it's something we want to look at. I've mentioned, I think, this very wide size distribution. This is a number I infer for the Punch Bowl gouge, which is very broad, but the claim of the people who looked at the South African gouge for the fresh fracture is it has a comparably wide size distribution to gallons of mature funds. So I don't know if everyone accepts that or not. And this is, here's a real problem, and this, I know nothing to do with this. Some particles are extremely small. If you look at those in the shear zone that actually hosts the earthquakes in the punch bowl case, you see particles following a power law distribution down to about 30 nanometers, and you see particles as small as about 10 nanometers. So Mark Robbins is not here with us. He would know at once what the JKR adhesion forces pull apart particles of that size, but I'm sure if you calculate it, you will find it's quite non-negligible. So we have clumping of particles. We have to have clumping. We effectively probably have some sort of fine-grained polycrystal after a while with very imperfect grain boundaries. But this is a real thing we have to live with, because when you have a lot of sliding at very high normal stress, you get into a size distribution where cohesion really is important. And by the way, the way people think in a hand-waving way about these broad size distributions is it's what you need to buffer particles. A well-known thing is if you want to split around disk, a good way to do it is to compress it that way. This is called the Brazil nut configuration, and it has the virtue that it puts a uniform tensile stress everywhere across the diameter. It's a favorite problem in doing elasticity courses. But if instead you don't have single contacts, but if you buffer the particle with hordes of contacts around it, which is what you do with a very broad size distribution where there's a horde, a lot of people at each smaller scale you go to, and all of these buffering particles are, you can think of as buffered tube by little ones around it, then you basically prevent the kind of stressing that would crack particles. So this is the idea that developed out of work of Jim Diedrich, Charlie Samus, Ron Bagel years ago. And it's the way we think about why gouges formed by wear would ultimately evolve to those types of size distributions. Now the other thing, and this was part of what we were discussing the other day, contact creep is surely a real physical phenomenon. The only question is, does it matter? And if we're shearing things fast, you could argue that probably the creep is unimportant to the dynamics, and simplified classical friction descriptions are real. But if you want to study things like, say, you've sheared and then you stop shearing and you're going to resume shearing and you're wondering how things re-strengthen again, the slow contact creep and compaction, secondary consolidation, as the slow mechanicians call it, is an important phenomenon. But you achieve packing densities that become greater with time, and hence when you resume shearing, you have some restraint in it. So there are cases where the simplified contact laws classically used in granular simulations are probably not going to be adequate, but other cases where they probably are. The classical laws, by the way, those who know this, people inevitably use Coulomb friction and coefficient of restitution. And that works pretty well in the granular gas range in describing the behavior of contacts. A group at Cornell and co-workers associated with Jim Jenkins have actually measured coefficients of restitutions for the same particles that are studied in simulations. And that's fine for that range, but more generally, it's not fine. I should have put somewhere up here, shape also seems to matter, because particles, no matter, ground particles, no matter what their friction coefficient, it could be 25 for the coefficient of friction of contacts, the aggregate will have a low coefficient of friction around 0.3. Not so if you have particles that can't so easily roll on one another, and more angular particles that have trouble doing that. So that getting shape into the picture is an important thing.
If I put together your first and third points, it seems that you may have in the system something which is actually more like a colloidal suspension or a clay suspension than a granular material. Because when you put 10 nanometers particles into water, that's not what is commonly
seen. Community I come from clays or granular materials. and soil mechanics. They mix with sands and, you know, we don't make distinction. Clays are granular materials too, but I agree with you that clays are important because they're tiny and because they have cohesion, also because of plate type.
So can you think as this, of this kind of suspension as lubricating bigger traffic lines?
Perhaps in the fault gouge case, remember it evolved under rather high normal stress. So the porosity of fault gouge, when you take it out, say from a sample and out near the surface, it's a border 10%. But once you crank it up to stresses, which we would think represent the medium depth of the seismogenic zone, then you're down closer to 5% porosity. So these are very low porosity aggregates. But yes, something like that could be going on, and there are really very few friction experiments which definitively study the gouge of the region that supported the slip of an earthquake. There are hints that having clays present do lower friction in some cases.
Are there experiments that look at size distribution issue so that if you compare
I can't think of such. I mean, of course, whenever you, in this sense, size distribution is fun. A number of people have looked at faults, artificially prepared gouges in the laboratory, the narrow size distribution, and have sheared and sheared and sheared. And what you do is seem to be the same thing you see in nature. The more you shear, the more you break up particles, the finer the size distribution. And ultimately, in all cases studied where the friction at least does show velocity weakening, you localize into an extremely thin band in the laboratory test. These are done rotating annuli with the layer of gouge between them. This is the work of Beeler and Tullis's group and later Valerie Scruggs in the same. Jim, know more about that?
Nothing more to say, but this is from case.
They never determined the size distribution, but it's obvious just you're looking at the micrographs, you know, a lot of tiny stuff.
Right, the experiments that Ron Beagle did, for instance, is, that Jim alluded to, was for me, the most interesting part was that the natural gouges they looked at, which were not necessarily a sampling of localization zones, had a nice power law distribution of sizes. And if you put in a well-sorted granular material in the laboratory and just sheared a little bit, it immediately breaks up and goes to the same sort of power law distribution to see the otherness that has this buffering storage.
I guess part of the question is whether or not if you really have a really broad size distribution, if it is, does something different in terms of the averaging process that leads to affect the friction law that cares about scale.
Yeah.
And whether or not anything like that has been seen. Or whether, because the contacts on all these particles, no matter what their sizes are, are broad surfaces, like kind of studied, whether or not that gives you an averaging in spite of size variations.
There were some experiments done on which hint at something which makes good sense, which is clumping of smaller particles in the active zone. There were some experiments done on what's called a lock sand. It's a sand where each grain somehow is pretty well attached to its neighbor, so they're good candidates for doing these clumps. And when the experiments were done, these were very slow experiments, but when done at extremely low confining stress, so low effective normal stress, they showed much wider localized shear zones than when done at higher stress. And this was linked by the people who did it, the clumping of particles together, particles. So, and given the cohesion coming in, I mean, that must be a part of the way this very fine gouge behaves.
So what do you think about heating?
Well, that's one of the reasons why we always want water present, because we would treat it if we ever get that far, would be in a very simple way, where we will have temperatures and sliding contacts in the process, which is susceptible to flash weakening. And then we'll have a different temperature of the bulk, and we'll just assume it's a short time cooperation between the particles of fluids and the places where the energy was fed in contact. So what we have to do is something similar to what the Nottingham group did, but bring in the fact that the pressure exerted by our fluid depends, of course, on its density and temperature. And we would be calculating the temperature, and we would have to calculate the density by some sort of Darcy flow, and by dilation of the aggregate, and so forth. It doesn't look impossible, but I think the hardest step is just to do it. I mean, the Nottingham group did the simplest version of it. To do a more complicated version seems to me not very much, any of it. It seems only a little bit harder. Of course, more parameters go in. That's always a problem.
Is there any work on rate and state laws that includes heating, temperature? I haven't seen much.
These laws are studied at a variety of temperature, but there are very few experiments, which maybe zero is a proper answer, experiments which say run fast enough so that heating is an issue, and then do things like changes in slip rates and the like to kind of study rate and state features.
Joe, do you know how to control the earth course?
Right. Well, people have, I mean, there are beautiful experiments out there. The group at Brown University, Rod Clifton, now it's carried out mostly by his student Prakash. You do shockwave experiments. The normal way you do shockwave experiment is you slam one thing into another. And what they do is tilt the flyer and the target. So when you hit, you have sliding and normal stress. And based on the thickness of the target, you have a very short time later a reflection of the normal stress coming back to relieve normal stress on the contact. So there are some very nice experiments that run that way on rapid changes of normal stress. Also, not very long after the normal stress perturbation comes back, the shear load reflects back from the contact face, and you have the perturbation of shear loading. So there are experimental methods which could be used to study these things at high rates. The rates tend to be a little higher than you'd like. It's easiest to do those experiments where you achieve, say, 50 meters a second slip rate, but it's better than 50 microns a second. So,
in those experiments, wouldn't there be flash heating?
Yes. Yes.
So the constitutive law accounts for flash.
Well, it would have to. I mean, the observations, if the process is real, the observations include them.
So Jim, if you have these kind of small particles under very high normal stress, and there's a lot of fluid, and the temperatures are high as well, don't we expect serious remineralization?
Sure.
And
that's probably what makes the small cutoff. Yeah, I mean, because the Chesters, when they do this punch bowl size distribution, see occasional things that they think are fragments.
Occasional, this is...
Right, and I think that's because you have an Oswald ripening type process where the littlest ones can dissolve and be flaked on, the bigger ones or just get transported.
Right, but I saw that they did not find, find abundant evidence for pervasive recrystallization that you would expect, you know, at high temperature, high fluids.
So it's remarkable that these fine particles have survived. Unless we've just seen the last
Maybe they are isolated from fluids by a little bit of mineralization, because once you saturate the, or once the fluid is, it, you know, you've taken enough something out of it and put it on surfaces. So it could be that you have vast areas of the material which are effectively non-communicating bodies of fluid until you start to shear.
Right.
and then the connectivity is reestablished.
Okay, but then, okay, but then there is connectivity, and then they're all saturated in fluid, and this is exactly, but this is exactly the time.
For a few seconds, for a few seconds. I mean, the solid state diffusion, things that depend on solid state diffusion, they're very slow processes. Which we usually assume are subsided. I said, which we usually assume are subsided.
These cores, when you take them out, they keep them under the same pressures while they analyze them?
Well, no, the.
They're on the surface.
Yeah, the.
Under surface.
They are not on the surface. These cores came up, and presumably from 3 kilometers, and they are not on the surface, the exposure is in the present surface.
So this 100 megapascal or something isn't, maybe it's a different material.
Oh, it could well be. I'm assuming, well, because D canceled out of my equations, I didn't make an assumption about D, but I'm just saying we have a granular material down there.
Do you think that if decompression could possibly cause fracture to it, it might be more
rock? Well, I think the decompression was, I mean, it was thought to have been active when it was still a few kilometers deep. So the decompression is slow geologic uplift and punctuated every few hundred years, which is a very short time scale by having a nice slope event. So I don't know the answer to that, though. We may get some samples from the Parkfield drill hole project, but that's intersecting the fault just here, 4 kilometers depth or so. I don't know if anyone has done size distributions for particles of the fault that slipped from the Kobe earthquake, but that's been punched through by a drilling project. Also the one that gave the Chichi earthquake in Taiwan. I forget the year of that one, but there are samples. I simply don't know what's been done with their studies. And they are samples, of course, from in the Japanese case, about up to a kilometer depth. So they're not very deep.
So I guess the question is whether it's relevant to think of the gouge as a granular medium or more as a loose rock or something. Where cohesion is a large effect at high pressures.
Yeah, well, I don't know the answer to that. I think this is something we have to understand how to deal with.
If you look at this one for it means that the small particles are actually occupying more space than the big particles, right?
Right, and you have to have a cutoff, otherwise you run out of space.
Yeah. But even so, if the small particles were monodisperse, they couldn't be higher than 74% back in the hyperbola. So how should we think of the packet?
Okay, I think that's a very good issue. If you have a lower limit, what is the, if you had a distribution like this, how far down could you go? By the way, let me explain what the actual data was, because maybe I'm doing something wrong with this D to the fourth. So let me, what these folks do is they have a micrograph, and so for the smallest particles, this is done in TPM, they have a picture, and they count the number of particles bigger than a certain size of D in that picture in a planar section and plot the number per, just the number per area of that section. Then they go to a blow up of this picture by a factor of 2, so the same distance is now D over 2, if that was D, and they make another count now, so they're always looking for the same size particles at the scale at which they do it, and they blow that up again, and so forth. So when they do this, they get the total number of particles in a size range D, so a size range D means everything from two-thirds D to four-thirds D, okay, if the size ranges go down by a factor of 2, this fits very well 1 over d squared. Okay? But then you say, well, their box size was d, so this is really a two-dimensional size distribution times a number of order d, so that means the 2D size distribution should be 1 over d cubed. And then we're going from a planar observation to 3D to put another 1 over d. Yeah. But the actual data is, and it fits pretty well. But say this is this is the 50 micron box. And the lowest one they have is the 50 nanometer box, which means 30 nanometers to 70 nanometers. So that's the observation, and maybe there are other steps that could be done to, but as I understand things, that would imply 1 over d to the fourth. That makes sense? No one else has any data, because no one else did the TEM method, so no one else has data from direct observation other than optical microscope, and that gets you down to slightly bigger than 1 micron. So the size distribution these folks have seems to, down to 10 microns, that seems compatible down to about 10 microns with what was done for a gouge in Japan, but of course most of the population is smaller.
Do they not see a rollover at small feet?
Yes. Yes. Basically, there is a rollover, and they say that they just don't see things smaller than about 10 nanometers, but the last box they examined is 50 nanometers, which, remember, goes down to 30 nanometers. So I assume somewhere between 10 and 30 nanometers this thing rolls over, and it would be very nice to have some theoretical work on where would it have to roll over in terms of there just not being size to put more stuff in, because where it rolls over has a non-negligible effect on what you estimate to be the typical particle size, at least if you use standard rules, which would say that D50, that the size where half of the mass has bigger diameter than that, that D50 matters. Of course, the experimental evidence for D50 is for much more narrow sizes.
So the Oklahoma group took gouge from the Tahoe Pass, and they made different type of measurements, not so photography, of particle size distribution, and they found out that the original work, also the particles follow the power distribution, but after 24 hours of very gentle shaking.
Ultrasound.
So what? Okay, it all moved ultrasound, but I thought it was still gentle, no?
Sorry?
After some shaking in the lab, the original power distribution all shifted to very peak distribution at the nanoscale. So the larger particles.
I don't think they said on the nanoscale.
I thought it was
submicron.
Submicron.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Now the particles here in this experiment of I guess there is cohesion between the particles in the that you know subjected to some small. Basically, the Oklahoma groups argue that the mechanics brings everything to peak distribution at a very small scale. And the power law distribution is an artifact of cohesion that is obtained later through water, etc. And if you just shake it a little bit, it will all crumble and go back.
Yeah, but first, I mean, they argue that, and they claim that other people didn't shake properly, but other people haven't done size distribution by shaking. They've done it rather by counting in the microscope. So for example, the Beagle Samus work, they said those guys didn't shake enough, but in fact, they didn't shake at all.
They didn't shake at all, right. So the question is, which experiment gives us a better measure of, you know, the mechanical was such a grinding mechanic, which making the measurement in photographs is something all day in Chester and Chester, or actually measuring.
No, I agree.
These are very different distributions.
I've seen those data by accident, I guess. In the first draft of this paper, they were talking about power laws, and I was looking at the data, and there was no power law at all in those data.
Well, I have this data on the on one of the pages. You can go to the KITP website, and you can find maybe the fourth or fifth page in the transparency PowerPoint set I showed. You can look at it yourself, both the size distribution and the TEM picture.
No, I'm talking about the one from the Oklahoma
group. Oh, the Oklahoma group. I thought you meant the...
Yeah, they say that, yeah, and if you had cohesion, the ultrasound would tend to break up stuff. It wouldn't break most virgin rock, but it would certainly break up. So it's very possible that it's a different distribution.
Now, if you had a particle with a grain boundary inside of it, would this counting method that these guys used call that two particles?
Well, that's a good question. I think they would, because they have no way of knowing whether those particles can really move relative to one another or not. I would say they're seeing grains. So think of this as grain size distribution, which might be a particle size distribution, but is more accurately a grain size distribution, if that begins to be so.
So if we had annealing going on with these hot fluids and precipitation and so on, we wouldn't really know how to talk about it from this point of view.
I don't think annealing is in the sense of, you mean like complete recrystallization of the grain, so we get sure the grain boundary.
I may not be using the word from annealing, but I'm thinking more, you know, these sort of cementation processes with the hot, saturated fluids, kind of pressure solution sorts of things. This technique wouldn't necessarily be able to pick any of that up.
Is this the real question? Is this important?
Well, what do you think? I mean, when you have particles that are that small, they often don't act as single particles. They adhere, and
the question is, what you want to do is to know of a reasonably reliable constitutive large set of equations in motion that will describe the motion and the yielding and the sticking of this kind of material. How sensitive is that going to be to this fine-grained description? There are indications, I think, in both directions, so far as I know. I can tell you some other stories that I think are outside the scope of this that are probably related. It seems to me that the first effort on the people who see whether there aren't some more general ways of describing this stuff, and so that maybe everything that about this grain size distribution is just kind of all boiled down to one parameter and some equation.
Right.
Because you're really going to have to get out and start knowing.
Okay. In a way, I think that's right. I mean, probably the most important thing we'd like to know is the friction coefficient.
Yeah.
And doesn't change a lot or only a little as you shear. But it comes in a more subtle way when we try to look at these processes of thermal heating in fault zones and when melting begins, because then things that give the actual physical thickness of the shear zone, and 1 millimeter, though it seems on a human scale to be an extremely thin sliver,
yeah,
is extremely different from 10 microns for thickness of localized zone. You ask how much slip before you start to melt, a very different answer. So at that level, we really need some.
So we don't really have, so far as I know, a good theory that tells us about the size of the slip zone, given some general. What does that size actually depend on? Which constitutive parameters.
Well, there is a problem that I'm very.
There is work on that, but the papers on that completely. Well, with fluids and heating, the homogeneous shear is unstable, you localize, and it is a. And as you might expect, the thickness is set by a diffusivity divided by a net sliding rate that you're accommodating, and that's the thickness.
Is that the thickness of the zone, or is this a?
Of the zone that ultimately shears.
Okay, because there are two length scales that you have to deal with. One is the actual thickness of the zone, and the other is the thickness of the skin between the shearing zone and the jam zone.
No, this is the thickness of the shearing zone, but now understand, this is a continuum description, it is not a granular.
That's fine, that's what I think you.
But the, yeah, let me break down the thickness, because the formula is somewhat revealing. So what we get, we misuse linear stability theory to get this, but then a student doing full nonlinear treatments of everything says it's not so bad. His name is Victor Tsai, by the way. So what we get is a thickness of the shear zone, which scales as, and this is complex, it's the thermal diffusivity plus the hydraulic diffusivity squared, it comes in a symmetric way. But now there's a factor downstairs, which is very interesting. So this is 2 plus the friction coefficient. By the way, this is only a discussion to have when the friction coefficient increases the strain rate. If it decreases, you just look.
Now, which friction coefficient are we talking about?
Of the aggregate.
The macroscopic thing, or one grain against the other?
Okay, this, there are no grains here. This is continuum. So the friction law used is that the shear strength is a function of strain rate times sigma minus p, normal stress. And what was done, I mean, if we make this weakening strain rate, party's over. There's nothing to discuss. It just lies on the plane. So the only interesting cases are where we make this, I need a prime here for a derivative, where we make that positive. And all the low speed experiments say this number is of order 20 to 60. At high speed, we only have simulations. The Shavar experiments say this number is typically of order 10 to 3. So it's a very big number downstairs. And it works on this thing here, where these are of order of magnitude 1 millimeter squared a second, and this is of order 10 to 3 millimeters a second. So that's how you end up with predicting very thin zones, but they're sometimes so thin that you know particles have to be important.
What is the reference?
It comes out of a linear stability.
What's the reference for this? Rice, Sidrinicki.
This is in the 75 paper?
No, in preparation since 2003, but slowly approaching.
Yes, so you did the calculations that you do a linear stability analysis, and you look for the most rapidly growing.
Right, it's a very interesting problem because it's a linear stability analysis with time-dependent coefficients. But it happens to be a very nice one where we can exactly solve for perturbations despite the time dependence of the coefficients. So it's, it doesn't have the conventional approximations that are made for that sort of system. But yeah, so basically what we get is a critical wavelength. So any perturbation longer than this is unstable, and it scales with, I don't know if I have everything in the right place here, I probably don't, or maybe, but the thickness of the zone is inside, and then we just say, well, the system probably selects a thickness, so the critical wavelength is equal to thickness, and that's where this comes from, and that's what the student Victor Tsai is showing us, in fact, not so
bad. That's a little bit more subtle.
It's not just subtle, it's completely crazy, but we have the supporting nonlinear calculations.
yeah.
But we know it works.
So you have equations, nonlinear equations of motion, and you integrate them, and you can see that it at least comes up in this ballpark.
That's right. And Victor goes further, because he puts in the various things that we know about the variation permeability and changes in sigma minus p. And what else? In some cases, he says, as the gouge gets hot, its rate sensitivity increases. That's what we see in the laboratory, but again, unfortunately, only for slope rate experiments. But when you get temperatures higher than 300 or 400 Celsius,
can you sort of say a little bit more in words what the origin of the instability is?
Oh yeah,
the thing gets hot and therefore it gets slippery.
Yes. So suppose you imagine that you sheared a little bit more here than in neighboring places. That here you get a little bit hotter, having more frictional work. That meant the local pore fluid there wanted to expand in size. Yeah, and the pore fluid is much more expansible than the rock, of course. And so to do that, it's got to push it out of the way, but it can't because it's a very impermeable material, so the pressure goes up, and that makes it even easier to shear more. So that's basically
and with thermal conductivity, or the other.
Well, either they actually enter the mathematical description symmetrically, so either one alleviates. If you have good fluid diffusivity, the fluid just does get away. And the pressure doesn't go up. And if you have good thermal diffusivity, temperature goes away, and then there's nothing to drive pressure.
A question I've been particularly interested in, because, of course, that kind of argument doesn't work very well in an amorphous solid. The thermal diffusivity is much too high.
Yes.
So you need another mechanism.
Yeah. Yeah, here, I mean, we timidly put it in the draft of our paper in 2003, and it was only after the student did enough nonlinear work that I became what I was talking about with nonlinear.
I take an implication of the second item there, where you talk about the size distribution, is the fact that you know there are certain properties like friction or mechanical behavior which depends on size. Is that right?
I guess the granular simulations would say for monodispersed distributions, there's no dependence on size, right? Right,
you're
right.
Well, I mean, it depends on what you put into the simulation, of course.
Okay.
I mean, if the particles get small enough, or I mean, if you attractive forces between them, the things you're going
right.
to change.
Yes, right. But I mean, neglecting the cohesive effects and just using classical
just repulsive forces. Yeah. Of course, it won't matter at all.
What I was thinking is that if you change earthquake physics to say material science, where we have things like hole patch effect, which is known to be important. Affecting the strength of the material depending on grain size, there you can, I think Jim Magner's comment about rollovers, the fact the hole patch effect cannot hold forever when you get back to nanometer size and it has to roll over. And then there's an interesting speculation on what is the limiting behavior of a nanocrystal in the limit of zero grain size. And there's some speculation that's not yet proven that it ought to go to the amorphous limit. In other words, the amorphous material is a limiting system. And that you can check because you can now do systematically simulations in small and small grain size. That's actually easy. It's hard to do the grain.
You know, I can easily see that as being very important for creep. So can you really think of that as important on the 1 or 2 second time scale during a major earthquake?
That's what I was saying.
This is just what I was saying before, is that you're burying all the information about the grains and what's really going on, and I think you're right. And that's exactly what the right thing to do. And then you're going to ask the question, okay, how do I make a theory of gamma that.
The trouble is, I won't say necessarily for real fault gouge because it has so many tiny particles, but if you had a fault gouge made of grains of sand going down the things, perhaps 10 is large, we would be predicting putting plausible numbers into this. We might predict a localization size smaller than the sand grain size. So in that sense, we predict things so localized that real physical, other physical scales have to matter.
And that's a point at which your analysis breaks down.
Right, but we need to know that. Yeah.
I have a silly question. If that size distribution is real and it's not effective cohesions that these things actually manage to all crumble back to about 10 nanometers in the end, and given that small particles take up so much room, is there any hope of making something like a two-fluid model? Or a model where you model only the largest particles and you have some effective fluid between them, which is determined by having this whole bunch of small particles in between?
Yeah, Jane, I think, has thought about that. We were discussing it yesterday. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, to me, I guess that's a question, is whether or not we can use methods that are bridging the algorithms for differential equations to describe flow properties of small particles.
I mean, from a simulation point of view, that we actually see something like this directly is kind of hopeless.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Yeah. So the hope would be to use stochastic processes for the largest particles. I guess we've been talking so much about the small particles. My question is, what about the large particles? Are the large particles, first of all, should I think about the large particles as chunks of, fault that's being brought in through the complex rupture process and rough sides rubbing against each other that are sort of working their way down the scale, or should I think of those, as just being, sort of stuck, as part of the intermediate? Are they brought in? Are they a measure of some sort of roughness cramp? You don't know. On the fault? And also, in a lot of cases where you have power loss, large events that are large things that have a very strong effect, power law, but where the things are so dominated on the small scale. But if the larger clumps are in some way important for damming, the question is.
Well, yeah, I kind of wondered what these large particles might do to localization. Yeah. Does the system just.
Well, that's a good role
through the particle, or and it's not just the whole distribution of particles and so.
For fairly narrow size distributions, as I said, the accepted wisdom of the community is the order 10 times D50. Okay. Now, for this gouge, D50, and in all of those experiments, 10 times D50 is bigger than the biggest particles in the system. Not true here. 10 times D50 is about 10 microns, and we have particles that are up to 70 microns. So. It's a real issue as to how big particles behave.
You would think that these, just to try to give me thought a few milliseconds now on your question, that these big particles in the fault, some are probably being continuously brought into the system, because there's going to be long wavelength features with eventually a lot of slip are going to start interfering and breaking. Continuously break pieces off, I think, at larger scales.
I have another question. I'm back to small particles because I'm puzzled by the fact that, you have a small porosity and for, say, some particle sizes which seem to dominate the volume. So if I go to the small particles, could I see that like something like, a polycrystalline system where I would have many small particles which would be in these 30 nanometers that you could observe. But then between these particles there might be some sort of grain batteries or some sort of gel because they are only silicate, so you may have some kind of gels, of silicate gel. Could you rather think of that as something where you have these tiny particles but in between something which is an amorphous system in a different phase. Is there any evidence for that?
I wouldn't know. I mean, I'm not very well informed about such things. It's not the fault that the gel persists or the self-deforming of the medium, but just becomes amorphous.
Yeah.
So it will.
But how do you measure the porosity in these systems?
Well, you, and the first thing you have to do is you have to get the water out of there. And then you make, you fill the pore space with argon.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And then you have jacketed samples with tubes coming out, but you measure the amount of, of gas that went in the valve as you increase the pressure. So that I'm telling you how you measure differences in volume fraction as you pump at the high stresses. How you measure it originally, I don't know now, perhaps.
To go reread some of the papers on that. Because in porosity characterization, you have tortuosity.
Oh, sorry, I do know. So, yes, the tortuosity, I think, is interesting. Well, yes, the way it's done, actually, is, do I have this right? Go ahead.
No, it's still that. I'm not sure I have, I mean, the small, if I look at the small case in this gauge, I'm not sure I should see that as a pattern of spheres, which are convex, rather than something different, which has a different topological
structure. Let's approach the sphere Cousini-Carmen. Does anyone remember the numbers that go in? Cousini-Carmen would tell us that the permeability ought to be like the cube of the porosity, the square of the grain size. Now, there's some preference. There is also another correlation called the Hazen correlation, which says for mixed aggregates, take D10, the size where 10% is smaller. I guess I just called that D90 a moment ago. So you might say, well, for a wide one, maybe you ought to use D90 here. But what's the number downstairs? I think it's of order 100, 200. Anyone remember? Come on, guys. Well, I'll use 150. I know it's big, and I forget how big. No, I'll use 100 because that I can divide by. So suppose we take 5%. So what is this? This is 125 times 10 to the minus 6. And let's take 100 nanometers here, 0.1 micron. So what does that give us? That's 10 to the minus 7 meters. We square it, 10 to the minus 14. So remember that used 0.1 micron, so 100 nanometers, which is kind of down towards the lower part of our size distribution. And suppose the number here actually is 100, though I don't remember. Well, let's suppose it's 125. Yeah. So you see, you get 10 to the minus 20 here, and this is in meters squared. And that's pretty much in the range of what people measure for the gouge cranked up to a high enough pressure so it has a porosity around 5%. So except for the fact that I've really chosen arbitrarily the size, it's not a crazy size, given our size distribution, but nevertheless, it looks like the permeability may be consistent with the way we generally think of permeability of granular materials.
If most of the volume is occupied by small particles, it might be more relevant. I mean, the porosity, small scale, may be dominated by, I mean, the packing at small scale might be dominated by the small particles.
So yes, that's why people, when they use that and have a wide size distribution, they typically use D90. They call
D90
because I rehearsed what 90 and 10 mean. So that's the logic. And for our size distribution, if you say we have a power law that goes down to 30 nanometers, then 100 nanometers is not. So, I mean, I would have to sit down and calculate what D90 is, but my point is it's not a crazy size to use in respect to your idea, which I think is completely right, with the tiniest particles locked in.
Of losing the earthquake here. No, we're talking about very, I know I've asked you this question, you've answered it, but I'm still kind of confused. We have this, we have an earthquake with slip of a meter to 8 meters to 20 meters or something. We have the slip zone, which is 100 microns thick or something, and this earth and the region over which the slip occurred certainly isn't flat to 100 within 100 microns. How is the whole how is this connected to that?
Well, but suppose you say after a half meter slip, you've basically gone through these weakening processes. You have very little strength left. So yeah, if you want to take things around bends and so forth, I think the strength is very small at that phase in the slip. So it's a more relevant question, I think, to ask for slips of the order of a half meter, a meter or so, how important is non-planarity?
Okay, but even then you certainly don't have, I wouldn't think that you have planarity on the order of the gouge thickness.
Well, I think it would be, of course there are stepovers, but if you look at, I think it's instructive to look at the study of the Punchbowl Fault, and unfortunately we don't have analogous studies for other faults, but if you look at that, you will see there's a very long, fairly flat region, not completely flat, but then you can easily imagine wherever you see little kinks in it, accommodating that by forcing the gouge to the side to deform a little bit. So
the picture's creep gives a rise to, forget about the constituent, you know, what the gouge is made of, but the creep gives rise to heating, which then gives rise to runaway creep.
No, it looks unlikely that you nucleate earthquakes by a thermal weakening mechanism. Another paper in the works, since 1995, when I spent a sabbatical at Stanford with Paul Siegel and never finished, but we are working on that too now. it does assume that the Raton state phenomenology is at work and asks, well, how fast would you have to be sliding in order for the thermal heating to become an important contributor to weakening and affect the stability prediction? And you basically have to be sliding up around a tenth of a millimeter a second or more for thermal heating to become important. And once you're sliding that fast, you're basically through the nucleation process. If you look at Jim Dietrich's calculations of lifetime to instability, once you're sliding that fast, you're talking about seconds or so.
Less than a second.
Yeah.
But to go back to the non-planarity issue, unless you have opening of the fault, actually, non-planarity, even small non-planarity, if you really think localization is so thin, will increase the strengths.
Is the gouge region that thin, or is it just some region within the fault cell?
It's a region within.
Yeah, in this Punchbowl case, and in the fault study, the North Branch San Gabriel Mountain nearby, and it was parallel with San Andreas, and for 44 kilometers of slip, it was in San Andreas in the bend in the strand. But what you seem to see is tens to hundreds of millimeters thickness of a really ground up stuff that's called ultra-heavy calcite. The slip zone, the concentrated shear zone, which may be a visual thickness of millimeters thick, but an actual thickness, apparently less in the thin section studies. That zone is within the ultracatacrasite or at its border with a coarser material, occasionally the host rock, and more typically a less broken up bunch of the granular stuff. And then that less broken up zone could extend out to meters. You would call it gouge and grain in the densely cracked rocks. And then you have a wider damage zone that might go out to a kilometer.
But could I picture this as a sort of a region of stuff which I've always loosely called gouge,
but the actual slip occurs in the interior, there's or perhaps at the pond.
Yes.
When there's ultra-fine damage in there.
Yes.
So that that could in fact find its way around various sets of irregularities.
So that's only.
Instead of thinking of that finding its way around irregularities, think of that as having been used to the surface for 1,000 earthquakes.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of determined where the irregularities are.
So it is the inherent weak spot, weak region in this fault.
You know what he's saying.
This is the effective localization zone. It's within the gouge.
Okay, but then I should not think about it in the simplistic way as if I had a shear region and the shear then got localized on some one of your instability kinds of things here.
Probably not, but suppose at the onset of shear there's widespread dilatancy, so you stabilize the material against the localization. So, but I suspect the answer is you should just regard everything inelastic as going on that surface, except for the fact that when the rupture front goes by and there are stress concentrations, the stresses are big enough to cause some non-elastic flow in the surrounding already damaged material.
But it exists as a sort of a weak region. It's kind of
fit. It seems to, I mean,
it's not a dynamic thing that happens as the object.
It's embarrassing because we have so few cases. There's no case for studying from the punch bowl. But there's
so in the laboratory experiment, already we mentioned several times, Jim Little participated in. You start with salted material, and then what happens? But it happens very
what kind of material?
Salted material. You start with some kind of, and what happens very, very fast, at small percent of strain, maybe 100% of strain, so it's a very early phase, you get fractal distribution over some range, and then together with this, you get
fractal distribution.
It's created of the particles. So the particle starts fracturing, fragmentation, this occurs very early on, and then there is localization, extreme localization, which is associated with the transition from to weakening, to actually velocity weakening. Uh-huh. And if you go to so in laboratory experiments, this occurs very early on, the initial phase of the shear.
So the velocity weakening actually is a...
It's associated with the localization, with the creations of this power law distribution and localization.
So you have power law distribution and segregation of the power law distribution, so it's not homogeneous anymore, essentially?
It localized within,
sure. Okay.
and in most of auto experiments, it stays localized. Rarely it delocalizes. Okay, so we get this localization, and if you keep on sliding, it just stays there. Now, if you go to natural faults, one example is the punch bowl that Jim talked about. That is about 45 kilometers of slip. But if you go to very, very small faults in the Sierra, you see these extreme localization zones also occurring. In other words, you see some damage and gouge, but the slip occurs inside within a very, very narrow zone. So if you now extrapolate the laboratory experiments where you get this localization very early on in some small faults that seem to have this extremely narrow localized zone to large faults like the punch bowl, and there are a few in between that also seem to have this localized shear zone over which the slip occurred. It seems that they are created early on and then survive, pretty much.
Created early on during the slip event?
During the initial organization of the fault to create slip localization region. And then this zone appeared to survive for a long time. It get modified.
Subsequently,
it get modified some of them, it survived. So in the punch bowl, you know, much of the slip and the same gangrene fault.
Let me go back to you. You're talking about a more controlled experiment.
That's,
and if I understand,
what
you're saying is that that the actual the grain size changes during the initial cycle.
Yeah, they took mono type grain size.
Yeah.
They started shearing it.
Yeah.
And what they got? They got evolution of the particle size distribution from mono size to power over some range. But it's occurred right at the beginning.
But it occurs because of segregation or because of the grain
fracture.
Fracture. Okay.
And then they got localization. Yeah. And once they got localization, all the action, all the continuing action just took place along the localization. Everything else became
possible. So some sort of an instability that where the breakup is, it starts going initially, it's going to be...
I mean, there are several messages here. One message is that these localizations occur, as I mentioned some examples from the field, they occur very early on. There's some initial transient phase that is complicated, but it lasts very short amount of time. Then you get localization, and then this localization seem to last for very long periods of time, geological times, thousands and thousands of earthquakes.
And what keeps you from just thinking of it as small grains and a thinner boundary? Right? I mean, if you're forming a distribution, but you don't really care about the large particles because they're passive.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Shouldn't I be able to just talk about small grains?
And I think some laboratory experiments, the Oklahoma group, or Morrison, is that some different about. In fact, they show that if you subject this gouge, it's a different gouge now. Now we are back to the sun and glass. But if you subject it to some shaking, in fact, it consists. They argue that the mechanical pulverization is really to a mono size, pretty much. It's peaked on a very, very small scale. So in that sense,
and that's where the action occurs, and that's the friction that we need to...
Right, but the story that you heard now is based on putting together sporadic observations. You know, it's one way of integrating all of these results, but there's lots of uncertainties. Really, we don't know.
Yeah, I'd like to mention one observation. It's not documented, but I've seen a number of faults in the field. And sometimes you see this broken up zone, this gouge zone, with numerous localization going through it, numerous. Sometimes anastomosis. The interesting thing is, and Jim touched on it, at least perhaps one interesting thing is that if you go and whack the stuff with a hammer, it'll split. You know, you have the impression that this is extremely highly localized, and it'll split, and sometimes it'll reflect light. You know, it's been, this broken material has actually been polished on a surface, you know, like a slip. But I'm a little worried that you were overly influenced by some of these more simple but dramatic examples like the punch bowl. You know, we don't have a really good and extensive sample of what these things look like. And they all have a complicated history that somehow they brought to the surface. And, you know,
lots of scenarios.
You know, it's quite remarkable if there's anything to see in the way. You know, these things are sliding along happily at 3 kilometers. Type, you know, history stopped for them, and then they were passively brought up to the surface without, you know.
So it's like four or five faults that this kind of extreme localization is being seen.
Just to say Dean's question another way, I mean, it seems like if you did the experiment, you come up with this distribution of sizes, and then you take the gouge out, sieve it, keep only the small particles, put it back in, shear it again, maybe you get exactly the same behavior. The faults I've visited down in deep mines, I mean, you run your finger on it and you feel this, that flour, that fault flour, it's really tiny particle stuff. And you know, to the extent that the particle size matters, we probably are talking tiny particles. However, it's not clear that, you know, all the dynamics is really just about these small particles, because the other aspect of the faults is they really aren't planes. They wiggle around. And
they have branches.
They have branches and so on. So maybe we don't need to think about a distribution of sizes. And that's something that could be answered experimentally. But maybe tiny particles in a flat fault isn't going to get us there either.
This is nature. You have string theory going on too, so a little bit of balance is needed.
I guess the one thing that I would just say that relates to that is your issue of side faults and all the complexity of that, and the extent to which, you know, there isn't you know, we talk about these flat faults and elastic media, and I think some of the things that you've been talking about too just strike me as maybe we need more of a continuum, even just to think about how the stress is stored in the earth. And certainly even within granular materials, there's a lot of focus on these dilated layers where it seems like all the slip happens, but if you actually really watch the particles, there are slow processes that are happening way out through regions that people have thought of as the bulk. And if you actually measure this, you're all this done this, you get something that looks like a much more continuous curve than what your eye thinks out as being the dilation shear layer.
As a matter of, and I think this is a matter of fact, it's really an assertion that all the slip is occurring in a highly localized zone. It's an assumption because that's where you see all the fine particles, that there's been more deformation there than elsewhere. But maybe it's, you know, we don't really know what the slip distribution is in the slip zones.
Well, I think, and also the large fluctuations could, in many cases, have to do with stuff that has, you know, bigger and clumpier and further out from some, you know, special small grain interface.